Welcome back to another episode of In a Perfect World, and my guest today is Tom Hatzis, the psychedelic witch, witchy poo stuff. How are you going, Tom?
Doing well, Rock. Thanks so much for having me on. It's always great to see you, talk to you, get together, drive you home from after parties, you know.
Yeah, that's the organic network of the psychedelic shamanic community, isn't it? We've hung out a few times at Martin Ball's Exploring Psychedelics conference or after the conference. And I must say that, a lot of the guests I've been having on the show of late are people that I've been wanting to follow up from the conference, because there's never enough time to do interviews amongst all the conferencing. But there's such a potent mix of fresh voices and cutting edge content that Martin presents. And you are definitely one of them.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I'm with you there, though. There's definitely never enough time. I mean, that conference, Martin Ball's conference, could easily be the entire weekend, like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I could probably still go for a couple more days after that. There's just the presentations are always top notch, and especially the after party is always killer. You get to talk to everybody and, delve a little deeper into their research. When they're on stage, it's like they're saying so many intriguing and fascinating things. It's like, oh, I want to talk to you about all this. So, there's never enough time, but it's good that in the age of the internet here, we could always catch up at other
places. Well, there we go. We can jump in and have a more in-depth conversation. So, Tom, I'm looking at your website, psychedelicwitch.com, which is a great little URL. And it describes you as an author, lecturer, historian of witchcraft, magic, Western religions, contemporary psychedelia, entheogens, and medieval pharmacopoeia. That's pretty good. And in your spare time, amongst other things, you coach roller derby. I love that. We'll get into that later. But let me just check. You've got a new book coming out called Psychedelic Mystery Traditions. You've also got a book out at the moment called Microdosing Magic, and a few older books that you've done. And I've seen you being really active, both on Facebook and putting out a lot of great information into the community of late. How's that all going for you?
It's going really well. I decided just recently that one of the better ways to get messages across is social media. I usually going on tour, just getting in my car and loading it up with books and going from city to city. And that's a lot of fun, but you don't reach as many people, at least not anymore. You used to reach people but now with the internet, which is fantastic, it's just you can get this stuff out real fast, and people, if they're digging it, can share your ideas as well. And before you know it, it's like, all these people that you would think would never even heard of your stuff, or like getting in touch, like, oh, hey, this a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend mentioned something and I wanted to reach out. And I do just want to say, though, that the other book, Psychedelic Mystery Traditions, is not forthcoming. It is out already as well.
Beautiful. Okay.
That's it says on the we got to change that on the website.
Yeah, available September 12th, and we're in October already. So tell me, Tom, let's jump into discussing some of this stuff. So, I mean, this idea of a psychedelic witch is a very potent one, but what is witchcraft, and what is it in the 21st century?
Well, I can speak to what psychedelic witchcraft is in the 21st century, which is a philosophy based around casting spells on yourself, not on others. I would, say that the witchcraft of yesteryear doesn't have much place, at least within my own craft, because that would be interfering with somebody else's will. So it's nothing I do when I don't think anybody should ever interfere with anybody's will, but more use your magic to align your will with your life and make the best life for yourself. And I think that that's really what we're seeing. That's where magic and witchcraft is in the 21st century. It's just people, trying to find, mostly a lot of it, I guess I would say, has to do with healing. First, healing yourself. And I think that that's, mostly why many of us are psychonauts, is because, there's something there that needs to be healed within us. And then, we can hopefully go out and help others.
Is this just sort of a different cultural issue, but a language thing as well? Because when we think of psychedelia, 20th century psychedelia is all LSD and man-made chemicals, things like that. But in exploring the mind, the historical tradition, when you look at medicine people, you look at witches, you look at herbalists, you look at people that were basically using psychoactive substances to journey with. So the witch archetype sort of what the West was left with when, it didn't have necessarily a shaman role in Western traditions. Could you talk a bit about the historical angle?
Sure. I would argue, and as I argue in my talks and also in The Witch's Ointment, my first book, that what we would call witches during medieval times were actually shamans. Like that was their primary occupation. That's how their clients saw them. That's how they saw themselves. In some cases, that's probably how their enemies saw them too. They just decided to demonize them instead of accepting that they were healers. So that legacy, I mean, there's scant a place on earth where you don't have somebody rising up into a shaman role. In Western Europe, particularly, which is the area I study, you had many women who took on this role. They are, in a sense, were the lineage from the ancient world, from the ancient Greco-Roman and Egyptian priestesses. I think they eventually were demonized by the church as these witches. Now, thankfully, we're seeing a little bit of reclaiming happening these days, where we're taking back the word witch and using it more as a term of endearment than, a bully term or anything like that. And people are really just throwing off the shackles of dogmatism in many respects, while also wanting to keep, that spiritual aspect of life, because, a spiritual aspect of life, that is, spirituality is part of the human experience. Even, whether you're a spiritual person or not, it is still part of the human experience, the same way I believe Terence McKenna said that, sex is kind of like that. You may not be interested in having sex with anybody, but that does not negate the fact that sex is part of the human experience. So I think that we're moving away from propaganda and towards a more balanced understanding as to what the herbalist, the shaman, the seeker, the priestess of yesteryear was really all about.
Yeah, and these are roles which are obviously, very needed. It's only the Western, I guess, modern, post-suburban type of paradigm which outsources health and healing and well-being to big pharmaceutical industry type thing. But, people are called to be healers. People are called to work with the benefits and the plants and the substances that Gaia gives us that can heal us and to mediate the well-being of their communities. So what are some of the more I guess pronounced or more historical record examples of witches or women healers or these roles through European history?
There are many. I mean, Plutarch writes about them, Pliny writes about them, Diodorus of Sicily writes about them in the ancient world, and many more do as well. Then you also have the ancient plays of famous witches like Medea or Circe, and I believe that they were actually based off of, if not real women, but actually like real practices, especially somebody like Medea, who was known to use her psychoactives for healing purposes. So again, while she might be a literary character, there's nothing unusual about a priestess or a medicine woman using, these kinds of psychoactives to heal. So you have a ton of ancient sources, and I go through a number of them in my book, Psychedelic Mystery Traditions. And then during medieval times, with actually the boom in literacy, especially after the invention of the Gutenberg printing press, but even before that, you have sources like Alonzo Tostado, Johann Nitter, who else is Gian Battista della Porta, Johann Weber, Cardano, Francesco Guazzo, Nicola Remy. So, I mean, there are just tons and tons and tons of sources that point to this. It's interesting because I was on a thread a few days ago, somebody who bought my book and I guess enjoyed it, Microdosing Magic, posted a picture of the book in a Facebook group, and a picture of the cover, and said, "Hey, this I like this book. Check it out." And the moderator of the group came right on and was like, "No, people were not using psychedelics and magic or witchcraft. This is a farce. Like, nobody should ever be doing this. This is bad history, blah, blah, blah." And it was like, "Well, that's interesting. Like, you clearly don't know the history." And I mean, not to sound like an arrogant jerk, but I'm guessing that this gentleman doesn't read any language other than English, which, if you're really serious about studying these plant medicines in the ancient world, specifically the West, I mean, you have to have a handle on Latin, Spanish, Italian, French, German, Portuguese. You really want to, have at least a baseline understanding of those languages, or else you're going to say something silly like nobody was ever using psychedelics in history. I mean, there's tons of sources.
It's ironic, isn't it, though? Because some of those countries you mentioned, like the big imperial powers of the last 500 years or so, both England, Spain, Portugal, they're the ones also that I guess promoted, the church and seemed to not just try to suppress when they were finding in the old world examples of entheogenic plant use in South America, the San Pedro and other plant usages, but also throughout Europe, they would try to suppress the people that were using those substances as well. Can we boil this down to sort of like a patriarchal oppression type of meme, or is there something deeper there?
That's a great question. So let's see. With the it's interesting. So with the wise women of Europe, they never the actual substances themselves, like the henbane, the mandrake, the opium, the mushrooms, the cannabis, that was never actually condemned by the church. What they condemned was the women's religion, this religion of worshipping fertility goddesses. Now, some people in medieval times worshipped this fertility goddess religion using no entheogens whatsoever. Just like today, some people go to a Christian church totally sober, and some people that I know in Colorado that are Christians, they smoke a joint and then they go to their Sunday mass. So you have to separate, in a sense, the substance themselves from the actual religion, because the religion itself of these women had nothing to do with the entheogen. They just used the entheogen in some cases as a vehicle. Whereas with the over in Mesoamerica, I haven't seen too many of the documents, but I think, and I don't know, but it seems like it was the same thing. They weren't they were demonizing the peyote practices, but they weren't demonizing them because there was like a schedule, a drug scheduling and a war on drugs. They were demonizing the religious aspect of it. So going back to the wise women of Europe, sorry, I'm going back and forth here, but it's just a big question. You have women and men using these substances in completely recreational ways that no authority, church or otherwise, cared about at all. I had mentioned a guy before named Giambattista Della Porta. I mean, he wrote about a friend of his who was very fond of drinking these psychedelic potions and, pretending he was a goose or a duck and walking around town all day, kind of pecking at the ground and flapping his arms. And, other than people thinking he might have been a little crazy, he wasn't going to get arrested for that. There's another case of these young girls. They were in a strawberry patch, and one of the girls had supplied a bread that most likely had ergot, which I'm sure your listeners are no doubt aware is the precursor for LSD. But this bread probably had something like ergot or something cooked into it. And she said to her friends, "Hey, let's eat this bread. And what's going to happen is we're going to turn into cows, and then we're going to fly to a witch dance. And this all sounds great and fun." Unfortunately, one of the girls ended up having a bad, what we would call a bad trip. So the girl who supplied the bread was executed for that. Now, had the girl not had a bad trip, this would have just been seen as a bunch of girls playing around in a strawberry patch. So you see what I mean? It was never the substance that was made illegal. It was always what you did with it, or if you caused harm with it.
That ergo rye in the bread often caused like huge inflammation and like physical symptoms when it swept through Europe in medieval times, and people would die horribly. So I guess they're lucky that they didn't have just worse than a bad trip, but any other symptoms in there. But it does bring up the idea that these substances were sort of known about in, let's say, medieval Europe, and they were around and they were utilized in a dynamic way, I guess, weren't they?
Yeah, and what was I just gonna say? I'm sorry that I'm so sorry. I got lost in the thought there. Could you repeat
Just
that? I'm so sorry.
thinking about how these substances, when we think of witches now and we cast back into history, and so much of our modern cultural archetypes of the witch is basically based on Hollywood and Western television. But there's a whole deeper aspect, as we've been describing, about the healer, the herbalist. And you were describing how these things weren't necessarily illegal and they were utilized. So I'm just, giving listeners an understanding that these substances were known about in, let's say, medieval Europe of the time, weren't they?
Oh yeah. Oh, and that's what I was going to say. Getting back to with ergot and the gangrenous effects it can have and the dangers of it, what it shows, it's a testimony to just how wise these wise women were, because they were using ergot and they were using it for its visionary potential. And you don't see in any of the records reports of the illness. I mean, unless it was, something like like an epidemic or something, like ergot got into the grain and it was, fed to a lot of people and there was no kind of quality control, then yeah, you would have those outbreaks. But like in Finnmark in Norway, there are some great cases of women who were teaching each other the secrets of the craft by giving them ergot laced milk. And again, that goes back to what you're talking about, that these were healers and medicinal wise women, and they were giving ergot to these people to teach them the craft so that they in turn could heal other people, so that they would know the secrets and the occult nature of herbs, and so that they could help those in their community. I mean, we know a lot of these women's names, some of them that were these healers. Finicello from Rome, Matucha de Francesca, La Strega de Casa Ripa Bianca, Maria de Medica, Piorino de Brippio, Sibilla de Fredegonda, Legio Fra Helmand. I mean, like these were real people. These were real skilled herbalists in their time and place.
You know, that makes me wonder as well. Is that say we've got this medieval tradition of witchcraft and herbalists and things like that. Where did that spring from? As you're saying, there's like a grassroots sort of outreach of people passing it on in the traditions, but there's an underlying, even older, let's say, mystery school tradition perhaps that predates medieval Europe, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have the Eleusinian mysteries, you have the mysteries of Isis, the mysteries of Trophonios. Like, I mean, in the ancient world, like, mysteries in the ancient world were like movie theaters today. You could go to one or the other or the other and hear or see some kind of drama played out. Sometimes you knew that it was, that there were actors like the temple of Hera at Hierapolis, where people would go and they would most likely inhale cannabis, at least based on the descriptions, by a guy named Lucian of Samosata. It sounds like they were using cannabis. And we know that worshippers of Hera used cannabis due to a guy named Pausanias, who was a Greek geographer, and he actually encountered some priestesses of Hera and said that they were offering up Asterion to their goddess. And we know that in ancient Greek, Asterion was what they called cannabis. It means little star, because they thought that the leaves on the cannabis flower looked like little stars. So you have, certain mystery plays, let's call them. And then you have other things like the Rites of Eleusis, where you were supposed to have a vision, probably stirred on by the psychedelic Kykeion potion that was being drunk. And the reason we all think that there was some kind, or not all, but the reason many people believe some kind of psychoactive prompt was in play at Eleusis has to do with the fact that, I mean, these rites went on for 2,000 years and more or less bestowed the same experience upon everybody. And this is not to say that a person couldn't enter these trance states with the right kind of shamanic protocols like breathing, fasting, isolation, but most people don't have that ability. How do you get like thousands of people to have more or less the same experience, well, that takes a psychedelic. You know, that takes something that nobody could have missed. You know, like a give them a feeling of awe and reverence, so that when they see Persephone rising in the Telestarian at Eleusis, you know, they know that they've become part of her mystery. So, I mean, yeah, these go back. I mean, the temples of Isis, they were using opium, probably blue lotus flower as well. Although Arish the Dean would probably be the person to ask about that. And I mean, and even one of the tricky things about the past, Rock, is this. So, in Italy, that's just one place. Pliny records that there were 90 different kinds of psychoactive wines. One of the problems when we look in the ancient world is, do you know what you called wine mixed with opium in the ancient world?
What?
Wine. Do you know what you called wine not mixed with opium?
Wine.
Wine. You know what you called wine mixed with mushrooms? Wine. You know, you called wine mixed with cat. You see what I mean? So
So
it's difficult sometimes to know exactly.
wasn't the ancient idea of mead, like, you know, what we think of as modern beer, maybe it's more of a Scandinavian Viking thing, but potentially that was mixed with magic mushrooms as well?
I've heard that, and I mean, there's no hardcore evidence to suggest that, but there's also, I should say, as a historian, there's nothing historically improbable about that. I mean, there have been countless societies and countless kinds of people that have used these things that we'll never even know about. So I believe if I'm not mistaken, that claim of the Vikings with the mushrooms goes back to Robert Graves. And I'm not 100% sure that I'm down with the veracity of all Graves' claims, but I will say, just historically speaking, there's really nothing improbable, you know, about them putting mushrooms in their meads or beers. I mean, we know in Northern Europe, like with the Yule celebrations, they were certainly doing that. There was actually a law that was passed, I believe it was in the 1600s, but it, you know, probably goes back further than that. Where they finally outlawed putting, you know, anything other than hops and you know, regular beers and barley into the actual beverages. And it actually names hen, not henbane, deadly nightshade as one of the plants that are being put, you know, in these beers.
You know, it's interesting. It gives me a whole new appreciation for medieval or ancient history times when you think there wasn't necessarily like the modern war on drugs or a cultural sort of sanctioning of these substances, but there was just an appreciation of nature, right? And nature secretes and gives us so many of these substances, like everything, all the foods, everything we do changes consciousness in some way. But then as they mix them into their foods or their wines, they wouldn't really maybe document that being separate from a normal language because it was just so ever present, yeah?
Well, exactly. Like, so that is a great point, Rock, because so I drive a Honda CR-V, but when I'm telling somebody that it's like, okay, I'll meet you somewhere, like let's say I'm going to drive to the Bay Area, right? And you and I are going to get tea and smoke a joint. I wouldn't say like, hey, Rock, I'm on my way in my, you know, red Honda CR-V with, you know, the license plate bent. So like, I'm not going to get into all that. I'll just say something like, yeah, I'm on my way. And it's implied that I'm taking a car and nobody cares what kind of car it is. So, you know, just as a very shaky kind of modern analogy to yours, I agree with you totally. It's like, you know, they wouldn't, like, you don't get all the activity, especially since most of these people were illiterate to start with. And a lot of what we're getting as far as what their practices were is mostly just, you know, the biased reportings of, you know, Christians trying to convert them. I mean, that's mostly
Well,
what you have.
this
So.
brings up the whole you know, conceit of history. In fact, that it's written by the victors, it's written by the people that have access and the time and energy and controlling the narrative, you know, as history's been passed on from one group of elites to the other. You know, how widespread do you think was this usage, maybe through Europe and elsewhere, of just utilizing plants as medicines?
All over. I mean, it just, oh, there's, I don't know of a place in in Europe where people haven't utilized these things, and to this day actually still do. I mean, if there's a spot in Europe that is untouched by these plants, and maybe there is, but I certainly haven't heard of it. So I wouldn't even know, like.
So what do we take about this this filtering out in, of history, or this sort of agenda that's there in what's the deal with the Roman Catholic Church and the history books, and why do you think there is what's the threat? Why have they constructed witches and medicine people and the plants and the earth itself to be, sort of a negative archetype?
Well, mostly it started because these wise women were kind of a spiritual competition for the church. The church during medieval times was a real, for lack of a better way of putting it, son of a bitch of an institution. I mean, they would be pushing, essentially like living in poverty and living, humbly to the masses, while the people, the churchmen and the nuns were walking around in fine clothing, eating, great meals, drinking at the pubs anyway, and people just kind of got sick of that. It's like, well, why do I have to suffer for Jesus to get salvation, but you get to live in splendor? Like, this is insane. So they by and large started turning to what the church referred to as heretical forms of Christianity, and also these fertility religions of the wise women. We have to remember that these were the traditions these people grew up with their entire life. So let's say, we have this village and there's a wise woman. Let's call her Arista. We have Arista the wise woman in our village, and we don't know anything other than having Arista as our healer and our teacher and our source of just moral enlightenment. And she was who our parents also went to. And Arista's mother was who, our parents when they were kids and their grandparents went to. And this was just passed down for ages and ages. And then all of a sudden, some priest comes into our village and says, "Oh, you guys have all been duped. You see why the crops are failing? You see why it's raining all the time? You see why there's disease? All these natural, ailments." They'll say, "Well, that's because you're turning to Arista instead of coming to the church, and that's why people are dying, and that's why your crops are dying, that's why your cattle are, this is all sick." And so they would get the people to turn on their wise woman, on their local sorceress. And we have this happen in the records. As far as them, the church trying to change the story or erase these practices, well, that's where the historian comes in. And if your listeners are kind enough to pick up a copy of my book, The Witch's Ointment, they'll see that the churchmen did not do a very good job of covering this up because I was able to uncover it.
So was this specifically a feminine role, the medicine person, the herbalist, or what we'd describe as the witch, or was it, a male thing as well?
So it's interesting. It was both. It was definitely a male thing and a female thing. What happened was the misogyny of the church came in and they demonized women as witches. Largely women as witches. Now, we have to break it down by time frame. In the stereotype of the witch, when the church finally decided that all magic and herbalism and healing and prophecy outside of the church was evil, that only happened in the mid-1400s, around 1430, 1450 or so. Like, there wasn't this generational, wiping out of these women by the church. That didn't happen. It started in, the mid-1400s and lasted till about the mid-1600s. And before the 1400s, I mean, you had, in fact, the majority of people burned for witchcraft and magic were actually men. That's a little known fact, but before actually, not 14, I would say, let's move it back to about 1300. the majority were all wealthy men because it was all political. Sometimes people talk today, they say, oh, they were burning these women because they were trying to get their property. Say, like, I don't know what you're talking about. These women didn't have any property. They were burning them because they were misogynists. They didn't want, it wasn't a property thing. They just, it was, it's a weird shift, and it's something else I get into in The Witches' Ointment. It'd be a big conversation to have here. I could pretty much take up the whole rest of this conversation talking about it. But what happened was, in short, men were burned as ceremonial magicians because they were invoking daemons. A daemon, which we get demon from, is a neutral spirit. You can, you know, we might think of demons as evil, but a daemon to a medieval Renaissance magician, a medieval and or Renaissance magician, I should say, is a neutral spirit. I mean, you can invoke a daemon to sink a ship at sea as much as you can invoke a daemon to help an elderly person cross the street with their groceries. Regardless, the church determined that all daemon invocation was an act of Satanism. Then, when these, so that happened, and that's why men were mostly burned for magic and witchcraft before the 13 and 1400s. Then, what you get is these preachers going out into the world, into these villages, and coming face to face with these wise women who are invoking different kinds of medical spirits, which was interesting. I mean, they would invoke these different kind of sprites and, you know, different helpers, like in a sense, like Maria Sabina called the mushrooms her little helpers. These women would invoke not mushrooms, but different spirits that they call their helpers. And the church was just like, oh, no, spirits, those are demons. You're worshiping the devil. So it was kind of like a trickle-down effect from the men getting persecuted in the ceremonial, magical sphere down to the women being persecuted in the village witchcraft sphere.
So, what is the correct sort of take on the historical record of, I've heard something like 6 million women, burnt or killed as witches over a few
No.
hundred years. What is the what really happened?
Yeah, so the number that we have it kind of narrowed down to is about 40,000, which is still a very large number, but nowhere near a million. I mean, not even 100,000. Again, 40,000 is still a very large number, but there, the I've heard like 11 million. I mean, if you 11 million, 6 million people, I mean, that's like 75% of the European continent in those days. I mean, especially right after the bubonic plague, I mean, there would have been nobody left. We have records for like surviving records for about 30 to 35,000 or so. And then, you know, you have to, you know, add on when you're doing statistics, things that might get lost or destroyed or whatever. So the rough estimate between 30,000 to 40,000 people executed for witchcraft during the
And were they
what's
mainly? I know
popularly
you've
called the burning times.
you've differentiated
What's
the.
that?
I know you've differentiated why the men were killed versus the women. But as it snowballed and started to take off, and they were focusing on women, was those numbers of people killed mainly women overall?
Oh yeah, I mean, you still,
So
again,
again,
you
you
do
still
have
have
some
some
men
men
being
being
burned
burned
at
at the
this time
time
because
because
you
you
have
have
to
to
remember
remember
though,
though,
let's
let's
say
say
we
we
have
have
there's 50 people that
that
are
are
tomorrow
tomorrow
going
going
to
to
burn
burn
for
for
witchcraft.
witchcraft.
Only
Only
one
one
or
or
two
two
of
of
them
them
were
were
actually
actually
like
like
herbalists,
herbalists,
practicing
practicing
wise
wise
women.
women.
The
The
rest,
rest,
the
the
other
other
48
48
or
or
49,
49,
were
were
just
just
people
people
whose
whose
names
names
got
got
dropped,
dropped,
you know, in
in
the
the
torture
torture
chambers.
chambers.
Now,
Now,
those
those
could
could
have
have
been
been
women
women
or
or
men.
men.
So,
So,
you
you
know,
know,
it's,
it's,
we
we
don't
don't
unfortunately
unfortunately
have
have
all
all
the
the
numbers,
numbers,
and
and
sometimes
sometimes
in
in
the
the
records,
records,
it'll
it'll
just
just
say
say
a
a
group
group
of
of
people.
people.
You
You
know,
know,
a
a
group
group
of
of
people,
people,
one
one
way
way
that
that
they
they
would
would
do
do
this
this
with
with
groups,
groups,
especially
especially
with
with
heretics,
heretics,
they
they
would
would
put
put
them
them
in
in
a
a
cottage
cottage
outside
outside
the
the
village
village
and
and
just
just
set
set
the
the
cottage
cottage
on
on
fire.
fire.
So
So
we
we
don't
don't
know
know
how
how
many
many
people
people
were
were
in
in
there,
there,
and
and
we
we
don't
don't
know,
know,
you know, the
the
gender
gender
or sexual
sexual
orientation
orientation
of
of
any
any
of
of
those
those
people.
people.
But
But
we
we
can
can
imagine
imagine
that
that
it
it
was,
was,
you
you
know,
know,
because
because
these
these
are
are
congregations,
congregations,
it's
it's
a
a
hefty
hefty
mix
mix
of
of
both
both
women
women
and
and
men.
men.
It's
It's
the
the
idea,
idea,
again,
again,
that
that
women
women
solely
solely
were
were
witches
witches
is
is
largely
largely
a
a
church
church
stereotype.
stereotype.
I
I
mean,
mean,
that
that
was
was
invented
invented
almost
almost
exclusively
exclusively
out
out
of
of
the
the
Malleus
Malleus
Maleficarum,
Maleficarum,
and
and
which
which
was,
was,
you
you
know,
know,
this
this
highly
highly
misogynist
misogynist
tract
tract
against,
against,
you
you
know,
know,
that
that
specifically
specifically
says
says
women
women
are
are
witches.
witches.
And
And
that
that
was
was
in
in
the
the
late
late
1400s,
1400s,
1480. 1584 or 1486, if I'm not mistaken. And so what happened was that book, the Malleus Maleficarum, coincided with the printing press, the invention of the printing press. And in the early 1500s, when the witch trials really started to get momentum, it was the second, the Malleus Maleficarum was the second most published book of the time, second only behind the Bible. So what you got was all of a sudden this mass pouring out of this one book that said that, women exclusively were witches. And so people worked off of that. And even today, some of our peers, Rock, some of our peers think that witchcraft was exclusively a female thing, and it absolutely was not. And what they don't realize when they say it was exclusively a women thing is that they are themselves falling for the very stereotype that the church set up 500 years ago. So, I mean, they're essentially agreeing with the church, which is an interesting kind of dilemma to be in if you're a witch.
Just wondering, you used the term like wise woman, and I'm wondering, is that like an archetype, or is that sort of something that has a lineage that has evolved through medieval Europe?
Yeah, I would say that it's more of a lineage. I mean, it's just a kind of a catch-all term for a woman who was revered for shamanic powers
Yeah, cool. And
in Western Europe. Yeah.
So where does the whole word witch come from? What's the etymology of that?
From what I understand, it comes from Wicca, like the old English term. Now the thing is, when these guys were writing, they didn't call these women witches, like these guys during medieval times. They were called Lamia. We don't know where that term actually comes from, though. Like that etymologically is like in the dustbin of history. We have no idea. So, as far as, I mean, the modern term witch, I mean, that's what we call it, but they never, like the church fathers and demonologists, they never used that term. But if I say Lamia, nobody knows what I'm talking about, so I just say witch.
Well, it seems like from what you've been saying that there is a lineage, maybe not unbroken, but with the modern psychedelic entheogenic users and their medieval counterparts.
Oh, yeah. I would say, I mean, ayahuascas, in my opinion, are just the wise women of the village, in our modern era. Women healers, I believe that you spoke to a friend of mine, Tara Rose, not too long ago.
I did.
She, in my opinion, is somebody who is, we could call that direct lineage of these practices. So yeah, I mean, I totally think that. I think that there are a lot of these people. My friend Yesia is also another one of these healers that I think is carrying on this lineage. She works with Combo. I think other friends of ours who will not be named, who work with other medicines, are also carrying on this lineage. Especially one in particular with the use of medieval ceremonial magic, kind of tied into, let's just say, her or his approach. And yeah, I mean, I think that the psychedelic renaissance, I mean, is just full of these kinds of people, really. I mean, especially in our part of the world. I mean, you drive up and down the West Coast, I mean, there's a seer, there's an ayahuascara, there's a priestess, there's a shaman, there's a healer, all, ready and waiting to give you the good stuff, to give you what you need.
So we've talked about the historical sort of appreciation of witchcraft then. Let's move into the modern day. I mean, we've got this psychedelic movement, we've got the medicalization of psychedelics coming back into an FDA sort of approved framework. We've got a rise in shamanism and ayahuascaras, as you've mentioned. And what about the rise of witchcraft? I know that there's people that are into occult study and using witchcraft, and there's a few generations now of different forms of magical use, whether that's like the old Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn or modern sort of chaos magic. What's the scene like nowadays?
So it's interesting. There are really two camps in the witch department. There are those who accept and understand that witches have, for centuries, I mean, since the beginning of recorded history, have used psychedelics in their craft, and there are other people who simply don't know their history at all and think that psychedelics have never had a role in magical witchcraft. And I think the major problem with that is comes mostly from two publishers, go figure, of witchcraft materials. They're Lewin is one publisher and Weiser is the other. Lewin and Weiser refuse to publish any books that deal with the psychedelic history of witchcraft. Now that's okay. I mean, to each their own, but the way that they're trying to write it out of our history is, I think, pretty disconcerting. And it's not going to work because we have historians like myself and Chris Bennett and others who, do know their stuff and have actually gone back and looked into the records and have pulled out, some really enticing passages that discuss the psychedelic state. So you have, as far as today is concerned, I mean, most of the witchy friends that I have are all using psychedelics within their craft. And there are some that don't, but they don't really like to hang out with me. So I don't really know too much about what they're getting into. And, I would just say to each their own, but I don't think that we should ever let our own biases, color the past or be used as a billy club of judgment against those who, again, just happen to know their history, really, is what it comes down to.
You know, it's not just witchcraft because the entheogenic origins of many of the world's religions, especially the Judeo-Christianic ones, are also censored, aren't they? There's a lot of discourse in the last few decades around the potential usage of mushrooms in Christianity, and there's, you know, evidence of entheogenic usage in other world religions at their core as well, isn't there?
So in psychedelic mystery traditions, I argue against the whole mushroom in Christian art thing, the whole mushroom Christianity idea. Christians were absolutely using entheogens, and I go over the ways they were using them in my book. And they weren't painting mushrooms into pictures, though. That's just a complete misunderstanding that some people have today. In fact, later today, I'm going to be doing an eye Pod, or excuse me, yeah, no, not an iPod, a podcast, excuse me. I'm going to be doing a podcast debate with Jerry Brown, author of the Psychedelic Gospels, around that whole idea of mushrooms painted in Christian art. So the whole mushroom in Christian art thing is actually very easy to debunk for any New Testament historian, any biblical scholar, any medievalist can very easily debunk it. So that I'll just put it aside for the moment and talk about how Christians actually were using these plants. And like I said in my book, I found, at least as far as Orthodox Christianity is concerned, I mean, you know what? I'm going to back up a second. I fill my book with three chapters on psychedelic use in early Christianity. One of them deals with the early stages of Christianity, like the Nazarene, the apocalyptic Nazarene stage. The second chapter deals with how Gnostics were using them, and the third deals with how the Orthodox were using it. Now, most people accept that Gnostics were using psychoactives. I mean, it's pretty clear from the records they were. So I'll skip over that right now and focus more on the Orthodox approach because a lot of people are not aware that the Orthodox were using this stuff, and not only using it, but encouraging their congregations. Like this whole conspiratorial idea that these priests were, this elite group of priests, was just hoarding all the mushrooms and all the entheogens and keeping everybody in the darkness and unenlightened is total BS. Christian authors were all too happy to write about their experiences. They were all too happy to recommend people taking things like opium, things like mandrake. Thomas of Prydain is one. Origen is another one. Thomas Aquinas, Hildegard of Bingen. They all were saying, yeah, if you're, the thing behind it was they called it the sleep of heavenly contemplation. The idea was that if you felt that the vices of life were starting to become too powerful for you, and you were starting to give into temptation, you should take a strong draught of opium or and drink and knock yourself into this oblivion in Christ, where you would meet Jesus and, he'd heal you and tell you that, you can make it and, you can keep it in your pants and you really don't need to go to the pubs and you don't need to go gambling with your friends. So, Christians absolutely recommend doing that. Another way Christians used psychoactives throughout the ages was the way anybody would, which is in recreational ceremony. Things like New Year's, Christmas, Epiphany, Easter, all of these were brought into these celebrations mostly through Saturnalia, which is a Roman festival that lasted from December 17th to December 23rd, where all kinds of psychoactive beverages would be passed around, amongst everybody, and they would decorate the cities and the towns with evergreens. It's where a lot of our Christmas traditions actually come from. And they also took a lot of the ideas from the Yule celebrations of Northern Europe, and they were definitely putting things like henbane or maybe Amanita muscaria mushrooms in their beers. And Christians and pagans married each other. It was one of the things that the church fathers actually complained about, was that Christians and pagans were getting married. So you do have this mingling of different religions, and so that would be the second way, would be with intoxicated revelry, the kind of stuff we all do on New Year's or, Thanksgiving or whatever. And now the third kind is actually a really sad and disconcerting kind. It seems that Christians were also using these psychedelics to, in a way, depaganize the masses. In much the same way that during the 1950s, the CIA tried to use LSD and mushrooms to brainwash people, the church, believe it or not, the height of the witch trials was actually using these kinds of psychoactive potions in the torture chambers. Because remember, as I said a moment ago, if you have enough people that are on trial for witchcraft, maybe only one or two of them actually have knowledge and have used these herbs in their spiritual practices. So the other 48 or 49 might not be used to those effects. So if you have somebody that has never taken mushrooms, in a torture chamber with thumb screws going through their hands or through their thumbs, and they start, you feed them the mushrooms, they're going to start having obviously a very horrible trip. And then you bring all the priests in and you say, look, see, the devil's got her. We got to execute her. So those are broadly speaking, yeah, it's very sad. And I mean,
History
I
just
gotta be
keeps
honest, man,
repeating
like there were
itself,
some
huh?
times, yeah, I read some of those records, man, and like I seriously started to tear up a little bit because I mean you could hear these women screaming their innocence through the page, and it's heartbreaking at sometimes. So the yeah, those are broadly speaking, I should say, the three ways Christians use these psychoactives throughout the centuries. Definitely not painting them in art, though. There are very good naturalistic interpretations for every single image. If your listeners are interested, you could go to my website, psychedelicwitch.com, and I have some articles there and some videos, and also the Psychedelic Witch YouTube page. I also have some videos that, I mean, completely debunk this entire mushroom Christian art nonsense. And it is nonsense.
What about John Allegro's claim that, the Dead Sea Scrolls contain evidence, of mushroom usage by Christ himself or that type of historical narrative?
So, Allegro didn't think that Jesus used mushrooms. He believed that Jesus was a metaphor for mushroom use. His book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, is actually one of my favorite books ever written. I've read it like five and a half times. It's really, I mean, it's interesting. It's very intriguing. But it's also completely nonsensical. It's word salad. His method of trying to decode the Dead Sea Scrolls, nobody, even today, even people that think there are mushrooms in Christian art today, like my friend Jerry Brown, he will readily admit that Allegro's approach and that his criteria was completely flawed. So would Carl Ruck over at Boston University. He'll tell you the same thing. And I mean, he's a brilliant linguist, absolutely brilliant. And I mean, they'll all readily admit that Allegro completely fudges. In fact, Judith Ann Brown, who's John Allegro's daughter, wrote a book about him called The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and even she says that his ideas were by and large ridiculous. I mean, they really were. His approach was essentially making up words in the ancient world to make his theory fit. It's kind of complicated to get into, but It would be like, oh, how could I even explain this? He didn't actually have the linguistic evidence. Like people tout, oh, he had the linguistic evidence. He didn't. He made up all of the key words he needed to prove his point. He invented himself because in the ancient world, especially you're dealing with fragments. Now, that is a perfectly acceptable practice. I'm not going to say that he was doing anything out of the ordinary when dealing with ancient etymology. The problem is that there was all of his mistakes pointed to him being right. When people went back and checked his sources and checked everything and found there was nothing to it, like, look, we all make mistakes, we all misread things, we all drop the ball sometimes. But if every single time you drop the ball, it points to you being correct, that really says that your theory is totally bogus. Like in my books, I've made mistakes. There are things that I've written that I've come to realize that, oh my God, I so totally got that wrong, But none of those things are crucial to my overall thesis. They're just mistakes I made. They're random. It's, there's a mistake here, a mistake there. And that's a good way to tell, not just with John Allegro's book, but with any book. If all their mistakes prove them right, that means there's something going on here that's a little deceptive.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what you've been doing. I know you've been crisscrossing America doing trying to get a Guinness Book Records recognition for your spell work. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I, let's see, 2 years ago, I went on a book tour for The Witch's Ointment. And while on tour, I took one of my magical practices that I write about in Microdosing Magic, a psychedelic spell book, my other book. This is called, it's a Kabbalistic protocol that's called the law of natural governance. And what this is the law of natural governance states that we are all born into this society, obviously, or onto this land, very obviously. And between the land and us, we can see 5 points. There's the land we occupy, or our country. There's our community within the land. So for you and me, it would be the psychedelic renaissance. Then there are your friends within that community. So, for me, it would be like my best friend in the field is Chris Bennett. And then you have your friends. And then your family, and then yourself. And so on those 5 points, the idea is to on 5 separate days meditate on what you like and dislike about all those 5 things to come to this kind of funnel down approach of how you bring your inner world to the outer world and vice versa. So getting back to the actual record, the Guinness World Record. So I did this spell 2 years ago across the United States, making the pentacle over the entire United States. And Guinness told me I didn't have enough evidence to prove that I had done it. So this time my partner came with me and she filmed the whole thing and took pictures and we invited people to join us at each of the stops and sign. I had a book for people to sign, that would be submitted to Guinness as well. And so this will be the evidence to show that we actually did it and we will hopefully get the Guinness World Record in magic.
So what was the center of the pentagram? Was that like, Midland America, Ohio, or where were the points of the pentagram across
No,
America?
pentacle, and the points were one was the first one was in Ashland, always a great place to throw a psychedelic party. The second was in LA. The third was in Columbia, South Carolina. The fourth was in Long Beach, Long Island, and the fifth was on the border of North and South Dakota, actually at Standing Rock.
Wow, okay. And how did that go? What did you actually do energetically at each of those sites?
Well, at each of them, we focused on the 5 points of the pentacle. So in Ashland, it was land. In LA, it was community. In Columbia, it was friends. New York was family. And Standing Rock was self. And so we just asked people to, really get together and, think about those, think about what they like again and dislike and what they would change about each one of those things at each one of those stops. If they could, and to kind of live your life based on your idea of better change.
Cool. Well, that sounds pretty powerful. How's that gone down? Was there any media attention? Like, it sounds pretty provocative, creating that spell around America.
I would have hoped so. A friend of mine who runs the podcast Day Drinking Saved My Life, this dude Matt, who's hilarious, he drove from Philly to New York to do, kind of like a live cast of it, which was really cool. But other than that, I mean, it didn't really gain any media attention, which is fine. I mean, that wasn't really the point of it. It was just more to get people together and, just show that magic is not lost in this country and that there are people that are still doing these kinds of things and still trying to use these ancient wisdoms to better their lives in the modern day.
Well, speaking of magic in the modern days, I see occasionally in my feeds some Trump-inspired witchcraft where they say, I've only read the headlines, I haven't followed it, but there's been hexes put on Trump. What do you think of things like that?
I think it's great. I think it's awesome. A colleague of mine, Michael Hughes, he actually wrote a book just recently published called Magic for the Resistance. And in that, he just gets into, ways that you can just resist this kind of fascist takeover of our government. And it's funny because you now have all these evangelicals that are now praying for Trump to counteract the hexing that we're all doing, and it's not going to work at all. My hexes are better than your prayers 100% of the time. So we're just. I mean, the truth of the matter is, and I say this. I'm saying this as my concerned citizen hat now. Hexing is fine. Go vote him out of office. Just vote him out of office.
What do you
That'll
think,
work
though?
way better.
What didn't you say at the start of the talk here that your approach to modern magic is for spelling the self, not for putting energy out on others? So, do other people then? Is this part of
Yes.
modern magic? This idea of a hex? I mean, it has a very loaded type of energy to it, I guess.
It does. Let me say, you are correct. I am making this my one exception.
Okay, well, there's always an exception to every rule. There we go.
There's
But
an
it's
exception.
interesting because it
Well,
does create.
this is a matter of national safety, though, I think. I don't think that's that bad an idea to get rid of somebody who, I mean, really has all the makings of a tyrant. I don't see that as something too terrible. I see it as kind of my civic duty, really.
It's interesting on that meta level, though, when as you said, there's all these, I guess Republicans praying for Trump, and there's this like psychic battle of wills, like that it's such a loaded issue, everything that he's doing, that it's resonating onto so many fields.
Well, it's getting what's you're right. What's so interesting is I think this might be the first like president where we've taken the battle into the metaphysical realm.
Yeah, interesting. So, lastly, let's look at your book, Microdosing Magic. What's some of the spells and some of the things that people can learn in that?
Sure. So, other than hexing Trump, as I said earlier, the book is all about spells that you would cast on yourself. And I do it, the magic is based off of my own personal magical system that I've used more or less for my entire life, or at least my entire adult life. And it has to do with recognizing what I call the four gifts and aligning those four gifts. The four gifts are made up of three spiritual forces, which is intellect, emotion, and will. And the fourth is our inheritance from evolution in physical bodies, which is action, our ability to take our intellect, emotion, and will and form it into something positive, in our lives and for society. So the book itself is different spells on how you align the three spiritual forces, the intellect, emotion, and will, and use them to create the kind of life that works for you. Mostly it's a rubric because part of my magical system believes that symbols that make sense to you are the most powerful. So I find certain like sacred geometrical shapes to be very, very, very near and dear to my heart, the hexagram, the pentagram to or the pentacle to name two. And I think know, because of that, the magic works just way better for me. It's way stronger. Now, for somebody else, they might have an affinity, you know, for, I don't care, let's say the gold and arches of McDonald's. Maybe that symbol means a lot to them. And it's like, well, if that does, then you should be working with that symbol because that's going to have the most power in your life. So that's a, in short, that's what the book is about. It's just, you know, ways for people to really harness their own creative energy, harness their emotional energy, and really bring their will out to the world. You know, each one of us, as Carl Sagan said, you know, we are individual, you know, pieces of the universe. You know, we are the cosmos wanting to know itself. I like to think of each one of us as microdoses of that cosmic magic. And as a microdose of that cosmic magic, of that supreme force, it is up to you to own your life and own your perspectives and go about reflecting that little slice of the universe in a positive way in your day-to-day, you know, happenings.
Yeah, beautiful. So you think that, a modern approach to witchcraft in terms of self-empowerment and sort of self-programming, it can create people that are or can assist people in being better aspects of their universal self?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are timeless traditions. There's a reason we still have magicians and witches running around. It's because this stuff works. Yeah, these are they're wisdom traditions so that you can make the best choices for yourself, given any situation. You know, Tarot would be a perfect, you know, example of that kind of wisdom tradition and kind of getting through the weeds and finding what the best course of action for you, given a specific kind of you know, a situation you're in. Whereas now with the microdosing with psychedelics, I mean, that just helps really breaking down doors and the gateways and the blockages you may have. So that's why I think it's so important, especially these days, as we're rediscovering, you know, the timeless history of these plants, we should also be rediscovering how they can work for us today.
Yeah. Hey, Tom, I've been meaning to ask, how did you get into witchcraft? How did you become a witch?
So I always, you know, and I guess any witch will probably give a similar answer. I always knew I was weird, wild and weird. As a kid, I didn't have any kind of formal training or anything. You just kind of know. And then when I was about 15 years old, my older brother didn't want to go to school. The next day, I don't remember what it was. I maybe there was a test he hadn't studied for, and he kind of just grabbed me, you know, as older brothers do, and he said, "You're one of those people. You can make it snow. I need you to make it snow tomorrow so I don't have to go to school." So I went outside and I took some dead grass from the front lawn and I put it in a I boiled some water on the stove and I put the dead grass on the stove and I sat there and focused, you know, my intention on trying to make it snow. And of course it didn't work at all. I had no idea what I was doing. But it was just funny because my brother recognized that in me in a sense that I still really hadn't yet. I mean, again, I knew that there was something a little off, but with me and just how I went about my days. But he really was the one that knocked it into me. And then when I was 18 and I had my first magic mushroom experience, and I'll never forget. I mean, my first thought coming back from that first trip was, "Oh, I'm not weird. I'm just a witch." And that was it. And it was just really from there. And I started writing songs about the occult and the psychedelic experience. And I would say that almost every song, and I've written almost 100 songs, but 98% of them have to do with psychedelics or the psychedelic experience or the wisdom gained through taking psychedelics. I mean, my early 20s, I mean, I would just eat mushrooms, you know, and lay there for, you know, hours. And then when that was done, I would start writing lyrics and pick up my guitar and start writing songs. And also with microdosing, I mean, I discovered microdosing, you know, in my early 20s because back in those days, we didn't call it microdosing. We called it being broke. It was, you know, my friends and I, we could only afford one eighth of mushrooms between us or like one tab of acid. So we'd have to divide it up. And we all very quickly realized, oh, wow, this is actually pretty interesting what's going on here, especially with the mushrooms and taking about, you know, 500 milligrams of mushrooms, and you just kind of, you know, you're not having a psychedelic experience, but you're certainly, you know, kind of getting close to that threshold of one. And it was just a very interesting space to work in. And to this day, that threshold space is actually my favorite space to enact my psychedelic magic. When I say microdosing, to be just straight up with your listeners, I don't really ever microdose. I threshold dose or more. But for safety's sake, and for a lot of people that are new to psychedelics and new to magic, and they're just looking for something, a positive change in their lives, I stick with microdosing because that'll hopefully more people, would be prone to doing that, and maybe work their way up to the threshold dose and then one day, a full-blown psychedelic dose.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of power to be had in the threshold doses or the medium doses because you're still got enough of your capacity to have will and then to exert that will into the larger field of your being and the universal being. And I think that's where this could go, yeah.
Absolutely. And it's also great for like the technique that I do is a mix of meditation and visualization. And the whole point is that, I mean, visualization by itself is difficult. Visualization on a gram of mushrooms is way more difficult because, your neurons and your brain and everything's firing and your whole cellular system is lighting up. So it's like adding extra weight to the barbell. And I found that my body started to react physiologically to my visualizations. And I have a little experiment in the book where, anybody could try for themselves, where, I show you that you can actually create a theater in your mind that's so real that your body will react to it in a physiological sense. And that happens. So, I mean, as just one example, just thinking of a sad memory, that might cause you to cry. Now, there's let's say sadly my kitty cat died years ago, passed on, unfortunately had kitty cancer. And it's like if I now this is years and years and years ago, and I could literally by focusing in on that day that I learned that my little super cat had little kitty cancer, it's like tears will come. That is a perfect example of an immaterial just emotion causing a physiological reaction.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? And it's a very crude example, but in my book, I have a much better example. I don't want to get into it now because it's a little long, but yeah, I would suggest if anybody picks it up to really try that, and you'll see that you can actually create these images in your brain and your body will react to it. And once I discovered that this was happening, I mean, this year I finished two books and my partner and I are about to win a Guinness World Record, and this is all from doing these creativity magic and these microdosing magic techniques.
Beautiful. Well, tell us about your books
Yeah,
again. We
anybody could do
mentioned
it.
a few of them, but tell us about your books and where people can find.
Sure. You can go to my website, psychedelicwitch.com, and all three of my books are available there. They're also available at smaller pagan and Wiccan bookstores. Powell Books here in Portland carries them, which is really cool. Amazon, of course, is a great place to get all three of them. So yeah, and on my website, there's also articles, there's videos. I have a YouTube page as well with some videos. There's a contact form so you could yell at me and tell me how much you hate my research. So yeah, just check out psychedelicwitch.com.
Awesome. All right, Tom, one last question. What's the
Oh,
deal
there's
with?
also wait, can I get one more
You
in?
go, one more plug.
Sorry. Also Instagram at witchydelic, WitchyDelic.
Awesome. So, one last question, Tom. What's the deal with roller derby? Huh? Huh?
So I joined roller derby in 2005, and it's just the greatest, most fun sport I've ever played. Well, it's really the only sport I ever played. And but it's just the community. The roller derby community is just absolutely beautiful. It's this worldwide phenomenon. It's this revolution in women's athleticism, and I couldn't be happier to be a part of it. If people are interested in that, I do actually my first book that I ever wrote was on roller derby, and it's my adventures in the roller derby underground from 2005 to 2011.
A roller derby underground. That sounds pretty good. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, Tom Hatzis, thank
Yeah,
you so
the title.
much.
Thank you so much for having me, Rock. It's always a pleasure to speak.
Yeah. And good luck with all your future witchydom.
Thank you. Thank you. And good luck to you likewise, spreading the good word and helping people out there that need it, man. That's great work you're doing.
All right. Many blessings. Aloha.
Many blessings.